Ray. Ray! Ray, come here. What is it?
That's Shelter from Oblivion.
Why are you doing this?
Why?
And I keep them in plastic, so, you know.
And the question really is, why are we doing this? Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Shelter from Oblivion. We really appreciate you being here. I am Matt.
I'm Andy.
And today we have something that I am very excited about. We've both been really giddy like a schoolgirl about talking about this. You might have seen from the episode title that we're going to discuss the 1989 classic, The Burbs.
Almost everybody's seen it, and if you haven't, stop, go watch it, and come back.
Yes, we're actually going to take a quick pause for you to stop this, go watch the entire thing, take notes, and then come back here. Hold on.
Shelter from Oblivion will be right back.
Right, directed by Joe Dante.
Everybody loves Joe Dante.
Written by Dana Olsen. I'm wearing my Burbs shirt today.
It's a very beautiful
Andy
shirt.
Doesn't have one because he doesn't like the movie as much as I do.
You know, I'm a normal core kind of guy. I don't like logos or pictures on my clothes. But you know, all right.
I'm sorry. Okay. I didn't know I was with this fancy elitist over here. I apologize. This actually transcends my original favorite movie. Like Ghostbusters was my favorite movie for the longest time. In the town that I live in, I went to see it in that theater when I was four. My dad took me to see it with my sister because he took my sister to see it and I got super jealous. And so he took me and my sister to see it again, which is crazy because my dad does not go to the movies. I don't know what was going on.
And see, I'm the opposite. My parents took me to like everything. They were young. They wanted to go to every movie. But the Ghostbusters, I did not see in the theaters. It was my very first VHS.
Yeah.
We rented the whole thing and watched it. But so you actually saw it in theaters.
I saw it in the theaters. I remember a little bit about it. The thing I remember the most is when all the hands come out of the chair and grab Dana Barrett. And I freaked out and I had to sit on my dad's lap and he was very put out. He was not happy at all.
He was always like, not happy.
Come on, man. Yeah. And, you know, later in my life, I reflected on that. I was like, oh, I was four. I don't know what the hell you were thinking.
Although, I mean, I think that habit continued throughout your guys' relationship. But yeah.
Yeah. Even though it's a good movie, no bigger Ghostbusters fan than me. We were just talking about how I found all my real Ghostbusters figures and they're pristine. They look great. Okay. So I'm a Ghostbusters guy. Bustin' makes me feel good. It's, I think a little bit of that memory informed the movie. So had I not seen it in the theaters, had I been like 8 years old when I picked that movie up, maybe it wouldn't hit the same, you know?
And The Burbs is one of those movies where, while it had a respectable box office, I think all of us saw it on VHS.
Yeah, I would say that I probably did. I did not see it in the theater, for sure. I would have been 9 years old.
Yeah.
And it just wasn't one that I wanted to see. I really didn't know a lot about it. I remember seeing maybe a couple of trailers for it.
All Tom Hanks wanted was a quiet vacation at home.
This is what I need, Carol. I need this.
Welcome to Mayfield Place. A typical street in the burbs.
Morning, Walter!
Where nothing much ever happened.
Walter's dog just took a dump on Rumsfeld's lawn again.
Until the Klopex moved in.
Klopex?
Klopex.
Klopex.
No one goes in, no one comes out.
Neighbors from hell.
It was a nice place to live.
He said he thinks the Klopex are evil incarnate.
Well, you're much too smart to fall for that, aren't you, honey?
But now...
Carol!
You wouldn't want to visit there.
Ray, this is Walter.
No!
The Burbs.
Well, in 89 was an amazing year for movies. My parents were like, I'll pay for this, I'll pay for that. We've gone to the movies enough to
see. I have an entire rundown of how great the 1989 specifically was an embarrassment of riches for movies.
How about we share that?
I'm gonna tell you. So in 1989, this is just a few. So don't come at me in the comments where you're like, "Well, you missed that one." I get it.
I'll put him in his place. So you got the comments for a reason.
You've got Rain Man, right? You have Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. You have Back to the Future 2, Ghostbusters 2, Lethal Weapon 2. Lots of twos, lots of sequels in this era. Dead Poets Society, The Little Mermaid. I was a big fan.
I saw that in theaters, actually.
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. I did not remember that was... For some reason, I feel like that was 87. I don't know why, but Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, The Abyss, so good. Field of Dreams. And then the movie that obviously, I mean, took over that year, obviously, was the biggest movie ever. Police Academy 6, City Under Siege.
Oh, yeah, because that was a big movie, right? Obviously. The one everyone was waiting for.
That was a box office dynamo.
Oh, everybody was waiting for
absolutely.
It. Absolutely. T-shirts and all.
No. And then there's this little thing, Batman came out. I mean, it kind of came and went.
Tim Burton's Batman.
Yeah, I don't remember that one too much. He had like a long car. It was like a funny man. I don't know. But no, I mean, can you believe Batman 89? Like 89 was...
Batman was so big. I mean, of all those movies, Batman was so big. I saw Batman in theaters on a Navy base as a kid. And when I saw it, they let people stand up and down the aisles. So they were young sailors. The movie theater was packed, lines out the door. And when I watched the movie, there were actually people standing in the aisleways, in the aisles, watching the movie.
See, I have a memory of that for... the Ninja Turtles movie. I remember they let people sit in the aisles to watch the original Ninja Turtles.
I mean, these were small, irresponsible towns. So, you know, this was not...
I don't know if... Did they even have fire codes in the 80s and 90s? I have no idea. But it's amazing when you look into this because the more research I did, the more all of these weird things aligned. And I was like, what? That happened in 89 and this happened in 89 too? Like, 89 might be the best year ever.
And despite all of that, Joe Dante's The Burbs still got a very good box office. Not the box office that Gremlins got, not what some of these other movies got, but this was a very respectable film.
Oh yeah, I forgot. Oh my gosh, yeah. So it came out in February 17th, 1989, and it went out against Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. I didn't even mention Bill and Ted. We also got Bill and Ted. If you needed one more nail in that argument for best year ever...
And I was probably at Bill and Ted watching that in theaters instead of The Burbs. Gosh.
Yeah. So it opened at number one for a little over $11 million its opening weekend. The film grossed $36 million
worldwide?
U.S.
That seems a little.
No, worldwide was $49 million.
There you go, Dante.
So before this, Hanks had done Money Pit, Dragnet, Big... and Bachelor Party.
Now, Big had not come out when he signed on to do this movie. And so when he showed up and Big became a blockbuster, all of a sudden they're like, okay, wait a minute, we got Tom Hanks now.
Yeah. And one thing that we both discovered, we were watching the new Shout Factory DVD, and they have a really good kind of like mini documentary on there. And that's the first time I had found out that Tom Hanks, when he signed on to do this, he was, wasn't he hesitant to do it because he didn't want to be portrayed as a family man? He didn't want to get pigeonholed as being a family man?
I think he was starting to be like, you know what?
You're starting to blow up.
My career is blowing up and I don't want to seem like the type of person who has a kid that young in a movie. Despite Colin was about the same age.
Yeah. Which is weird because it's funny when you watch the movie knowing that, you realize that something like that had to be at play because he really is not a dad in this movie. He has a son, but you never see them interact. Basically, he never talks to his son in this movie.
You know he's a good dad, but you know what? He's on vacation for the week.
Oh yeah, no, I think he's on vacation for life. Ray's actually not a very likable figure. Like Tom Hanks brought a lot of likability to Ray. Because in the script, he's even more flat and dim-witted. So in that work print version, though, the character of Ray and Carol are far more adversarial. They really do have these more almost like blow-up moments that aren't funny, and I'm glad that they're gone because they almost make the characters too mean towards each other to be likable at all.
Well, I think that's one of the geniuses of Joe Dante is he's so good at casting. He'll really fight to get people in there that he thinks are going to be good for the movie, not just good for the box office. And I think bringing Tom Hanks and Carrie Fisher in really just softened those edges. Because like, you hear the arguments. It kind of reminds, you know, you've heard some of that. You know, it's those arguments you sort of hear in the background, but it never gets too mean, I think, in the movie.
Well, yeah, and I'm glad that whatever his original vision was, that he went back and revised it. Because I think the movie, based on the work print, like if the work print movie had come out, I just don't think it's as good and solid and likable. I think it honestly becomes a little generic. And so the tightening up that happened between that print and the real movie, I think were all really positive choices.
Well, I think this was a movie so much of contrast that you just had to soften all those edges to really make it work. And I think that's what the final cut gives us.
I think that the one thing the final cut loses that I'm fine with is that from the original concept of the script all the way through to the end, this really is supposed to be some wacky treatment of like suburban living. We're really supposed to be getting that message. Oh, suburban living is crazy. Isn't the suburbs so wacky?
Here's what the suburbs promised you. Here's what you're really getting.
Yeah. And I don't think that the movie in a good way delivers on that because I think that is such a strange and narrow way of thinking. And some of the dialogue that was in the original script or even in the work print ending, it's just too much. You're just being hit over the head with the concept. And I think that this is a much better, softer, like you had said, softer, like a softer way of delivering that message. It's just people living in a cul-de-sac and it's called the burbs. And it's like, those are the two key things you need.
And
you
the general
you get it from there.
The general rule in movie making is you make it three times. The first time you make it is in the script. The second time you make it is on set, all those happy accidents, what the actors and everyone else brings to the film. And then the third time is in the edit room when you really start to see maybe some of this isn't working. Let's soften these edges. Let's tighten this story.
Yeah.
And I think the movie, I mean, it exemplifies. I mean, it's a great film.
Yeah. When I think about this movie, one of the things that when we first even started talking about like doing it as an episode, I was like, I don't want to have so much data as much as like I want to do feelings, like what we feel about it. Because like that's what a lot of people think about when they think about movies. They think about, oh, these movies make me feel this way. And this movie always makes me feel like summer and sleepovers and pizza with black olives on it. I don't know why, but I always, when I think the burbs, I think 2 liters of Pepsi and then I think pizza and I usually think like video games and a sleeping bag.
Yeah, because like I know, I mean, when I found this movie, it was, you know, at a video store, there was probably some display, and you're a little confused because you're like, okay, Tom Hanks, I think at the time I knew who Joe Dante was, you know, I was still pretty young.
Oh, I certainly did not know who
Joe Dante was. I think there was a little like buzz of like, it's a guy who made Gremlins, and it's Tom Hanks, and is it a horror film? Is it a comedy? And so remember this, you had no internet. You had no way of looking at previews. You just had to go off the cover of the box.
Yeah, you have Tom Hanks. He's got a fly swatter, and he's got a hose in the other hand, and he's sort of in like his PJs. He's in his PJs. I think he has like a thin robe on, and something is amiss. The sky is dark behind him, and so you're like, okay, I have no idea what's happening here, but you know. I did know Tom Hanks at the time because even though I was 9, yes, I had watched Bachelor Party. I pretty much
I think we'd all seen that.
Yeah, I had like no filter on most of the stuff that I watched when I was a child, as you can tell. And I remember seeing Money Pit, but I didn't register because it's like it's a movie about a man who buys a house. And he's all angry about it. And it's like, that doesn't go into my head. Yeah. But then you see Bachelor
Party. Splash, Bachelor Party.
Oh, yeah, Bachelor Party. You got like guys like drinking and like there's a guaranteed side of breasts. Like, yeah, no, I'm on board. That holds in my brain a little bit better.
And so, yeah. And then now here's Tom Hanks as a dad. And you're like, okay, you didn't know what you were getting into. You couldn't watch a preview. You just had to go by the faith of the box cover. And again, I think critics at the time, I think studios had at the time, they were worried, are people going to understand this as a comedy? Are people going to think this is a horror film? They're not quite. We were still so young, we didn't know the rules. So when this movie came out, it made perfect sense to us to have a comedy and a horror in one.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of had assumed, you know, with my like 9-year-old brain that like Tom Hanks is in it, so it's probably going to be funny because he hadn't done a serious movie yet for the most part. But I was like, how much horror is there going to be in this? Or is it all going to be like jokes? Is it all going to be sort of like cartoony? And I had no idea, and that's why I had to watch it. And right away, it was just really good. I really enjoyed it.
Well, in the movie, I mean, you're confused when you first watch it. You don't quite, you know, every moment of this film is revealing something. Because along with being a horror film and a comedy, it's a mystery.
Yeah. And what's funny is the more you watch it, as we've, because I think to do this podcast, I watched it at least 3 times.
Yeah, me too.
Just to get ready for this.
On top of the hundreds of times.
Well, yeah, on top of all the times I'd watched it before, but it's like you watch it when you're a kid and you kind of think one way. And of course, when you're an adult, it hits a little bit of a different way. And watching it now, yeah, it's like there's something, this is a gift that keeps on giving kind of movie, because the more you watch it and the more you look in the background and the more you look at the characters who are not speaking and what they're physically doing and everything, there's just more and more. And honestly, like I told you earlier, I took a bunch of notes from watching it last night, and I have more questions than answers now about what's going on in this movie. This movie is wild.
Oh, I have so many questions.
In the fact that like, there's just stuff that like doesn't connect. And there's so many things that are so strange about, the world they're living in. Like, you know, just like this is a alternate universe Earth where these people are living for sure.
You know, the suburbs.
Yes. But yeah, so the writer Dana Olsen, we brought him up multiple times. He also wrote George of the Jungle, 1997, and Inspector Gadget, 1999. You also had brought up, you have a lot to say about him making 1983's Going Berserk with John Candy.
Yeah, so, you know, looking Olsen up, I saw that, you know, he'd worked with John Candy in 1983 for Berserk. Just as John Candy John Candy blew up pretty quickly once he got into movies. You know, the next year, John Candy does Splash. Ron Howard directs it. Olsen makes a little cameo. And Splash surprisingly has Tom Hanks and John Candy in a movie together. And I kind of think when Olsen started writing this film, can I get into this? Or?
We talked about this.
This is just a fan theory I have, and I could be completely wrong. But I'm looking at this film, and I'm like, I think that maybe some of the studio heads or maybe some of the other people were thinking John Candy might be the good that, you know, would have played a good art.
Yeah. Rick Ducamon, who plays, am I saying that right? Ducamon, who plays Art Weingartner in this movie. We had both independently said to each other, like, we really feel like this is a John Candy role. Like the way, I mean, no disrespect to the way Rick did it, but it's like, the things that are being said, even in like the script that I read, like a lot of it is not like made up by Rick. Like a lot of it is in the script, and it does feel very John Candy-esque. The whole role feels like it was somewhat maybe tailored for him.
And for me, I'm glad they actually picked Rick for this, because for me, I think when the movie did such a great job of softening the edges of Carol and Ray's fighting. But I think Rick gives a little bit more edge to Art than John Candy would have given.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that ultimately it was probably a good idea because he has such a unique way of speaking, and he does have sort of his own comedy style that I think he was more adversarial to the Ray character. And apparently they were not adversarial on set, but they did have different feelings about how the acting should be done.
And I think he stole the show. For me, what I love is because when you're a kid, you've never seen him before. Like you later see him in the movies like Experts and other things he pops up in, but I had not seen him. He really looks like, he seems like a guy who was just living in the suburbs and just wandered on the set and took over the movie. Like he has that vibe, and I think it works so well for the film.
Yeah, I would say that he definitely comes in. His scene where he comes in and he immediately shoots Ray's back porch light.
Art's got a gun.
Hey, hi, Ray. Hey, what are you guys eating in there?
Like that is the perfect visual, you know, representation of Art. He just comes in and at that moment, he's not only has taken over that scene, he takes over the movie pretty much.
And I had to do some research. So I look back, Variety Review in 1988, they say one of the big breakthrough performances is from Dukeman, Rick Dukeman, in a superb role that would have well suited John Candy. So even the Variety was thinking this when they wrote the review.
See, we had those vibes too.
And in 1989, I think it was the Seattle Herald, it was some Herald, Rick Dukeman had commented to the reporter that this was a sizable role, that when he was going out for the role, he thought he had a better chance of winning the lottery than being in a movie this big, packed with so many great people. And he was even a little surprised when he got it because apparently Universal and Imagine didn't really want him for this role. I don't know if Dante fought for him, but Dante has a history of casting well, so I think he did. But he said once he got on set, everyone was gracious and kind to him. And I really do think he made the film.
Yeah. No, I think so as well. And you, speaking of all the people who are in this movie, obviously everyone, like we said, went and watched this movie and they're listening because you've already seen this, but I think it bears repeating that some of the other people in this movie were, you know, besides Tom Hanks and Carrie Fisher, Bruce Dern is in this movie. And apparently him on set, he was just an absolute riot. And since this film was made during the writer's strike and they really couldn't have a writer go back in and like fix dialogue or anything, a lot of the dialogue in this movie, if it wasn't already in the shooting script, they just had to make up on the spot. It's a kind of a way to get around that whole issue. And I guess Mark,
I think here Dante really he embraces improv because Joe Dante is known as a director. Like some directors, they get a script and then they're like, okay, get the writer out of here. We don't want the writer telling me how the movie's supposed to be. Joe Dante is the opposite. Joe Dante loves to have the writer on set. One of his mottos is, if it's not on the page, it's not on the stage. So Joe Dante really embraces writers. In a lot of his films, he's found ways to bring them onto the cast so they can be there and help do rewrites. And here, there was a writer's strike, so I think it was a lot of improv that he embraced, and it worked.
Yeah, well, and he kind of had to. And Bruce Dern, he improvised that line, "Hey, Pinocchio!
Hey, Pinocchio! Where are you going?"
Yeah, so I thought that was really cool to find out.
Bruce Dern's great because, I mean, a lot of his roles before this, he goes back to the 70s, and he plays a lot of serious or like a lot of like grumpy kind of characters. You know, he's Tom Buchanan in The Great Gatsby. He's playing Rumsfeld here, who, you know, is a little grumpy, a little upset with Walter, does not like Queenie.
Nope.
On set, I mean, he's just like Tom Hanks. Like, everybody loves him. He has like a memory for everything. He would play little games on set where they would do like set up little pools on who's going to win the game tonight. He'd do trivia with everybody. And everyone says he has an amazing memory.
Oh, what a dude. I think, what was it? Wendy Shaw was talking about how like he was like asking her a bunch of questions about
what high school did you go to?
Like the high school she went to.
And
like,
apparently he follows track and field for all these different high schools.
Wow. Why?
You know, the what guy just happening does not forget him? Anything.
No.
All about trivia. But just the kindest guy. It's such a contrast to some of the characters he's played.
What an insane thing to follow on. But speaking of, like Wendy Shaw is in this movie, and a lot of people will know her now from being the mom from American Dad.
Roger, just have a look around. There are plenty of other fish in the sea.
I know you're proud of yourself for coming up with that, but I just want Klaus back.
Well, when you love someone, you have to go after them.
Is that how you got Stan?
Bitch, I look like this. Homegirl don't chase. Homegirl gets chased.
Yeah, that's right? That's right.
Which I haven't seen American Dad in a while. But
and she credits this movie, right?
Yeah, she does. She credits fans of the Burbs as the people who pushed Seth MacFarlane to hire her for the show. As Werner Klopek, you have Henry Gibson, who I knew Henry Gibson from watching old Nick at Night episodes of Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In.
Like, I didn't know who he was, but I recognized him from a lot of stuff my parents watched.
I loved that show so much as a kid. I did not understand the jokes necessarily, but there was a lot of wacky sets. And then Henry Gibson would come out and he would do like his sort of like poetry for like sensitive men.
Now for an interesting change of pace.
Elements by Henry Gibson. I used to like fresh air when it was there, and water, I enjoyed it till we destroyed it. Each day the land's diminished. I think I'm finished.
And that was always funny. And so it's great to see him in this role, you know, after like going from that character, very soft-spoken, you know, very peaceful, and then just slam cut in my memory to him being like an evil doctor.
And you know that Dante knows that a lot of people know who this guy is, because you're in the living room. It's very uncomfortable. Nobody wants to talk. And when he makes his screen intro, you have the door open like an old 50s sci-fi. You have that big overwhelming shadow.
Yeah, the giant cartoon shadow.
And then he walks through and it's just soft, breaks the mood. It's very funny.
Ah, we have guests.
I love that.
And that's what this movie is so great at. It's the whole movie from beginning to end is just full of contrast.
Yes, we have Uncle Reuben's brother Theodore, which I know nothing about, but apparently this guy has a pretty big past as that brother Theodore character. I did not do any research into this, but I did. If you want to know more about brother Theodore, you can definitely learn it, I think, from the Burbs Minute podcast. I actually listened to that entire thing. It's like 90 episodes, but they go through the Burbs minute by minute. And that's a, don't leave our podcast to go check it out. Check it out after.
We'll be done soon.
Stay here with us.
Go listen to them later.
But yeah, but then you should really check that out. Like if you are deeply interested in a literal minute by minute dissection of the Burbs, they do a really good job, and they go into Brother Theodore a little bit. And Courtney Gaines is Hans Klopek, and you watch. He looks really good in the fact that he looks really bad, because I feel like a lot of people would recognize Courtney Gaines from other things he's done. But this movie does such a good job of like hiding his real face under that beard and the big creepy teeth and like the purple under his eyes. Like he hasn't slept in like 10 years.
I think this plays to the genius of Dante and his casting. He's so, I mean, look through all his films. And he finds just great characters all throughout. And I think Gaines even says that like Dante had looked at a lot of people and just he saw who this guy was going to be before even Gaines didn't quite get it either.
Yeah.
But Dante puts it on screen and gives us this perfect Hans.
Well, yeah. And if for some reason you don't know who he is, and I completely understand, this son of a bitch almost ruined George and Elaine's. Was it George and Elaine? From Back to the Future, George was going into the dance, right? The chicken under the sea dance. And Marty's up on stage and he's playing and he, you know, they punched out Biff, right? Things are over. Like we're on easy street now. And then Courtney Gaines comes up, this redheaded bastard, and he goes, "Scram, McFly!
Scram, McFly, cutting in."
And he pushes George McFly down, and then he takes Elaine, right? Lorraine.
This isn't Seinfeld.
I'm getting my wires crossed. George and Elaine are now in Seinfeld, or the Back to the Future universe. So yeah,
which would have still been that same sort of odd tension.
We're gonna cut all this out. Don't worry. I'm gonna be right when this is finished. I'm gonna ADR.
Oh, come on, you gotta keep in some of the room.
No, I'm gonna ADR over all this and I will be correct. And then all of a sudden you have Lorraine going, "George, please." And then like Marty's hand starts disappearing and everything. So this guy almost disappeared. Marty,
and then you
completely.
Have Bruce Dern just pop in again and say, "Where are you going, Pinocchio?"
Yes.
"Don't you make a move, Sonny. I was 18 months in the bush and I could snap your neck in a heartbeat."
But yeah, and he's also, this is a deeper cut. He's in Can't Buy Me Love.
Really?
Remember, he is the main nerd. You can say nerd, right? Can you still say nerd?
You could back then.
Okay, well, so pretend that we're playing by 1989 rules. He was the main nerd's best friend, where later he like threw a bag
of... broke his arm in high school.
He like threw a bag of shit at his... house, didn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, yeah.
That was also Courtney Gaines.
And Courtney Gaines, yeah, he's talking to the jocks, because in the 80s it was the nerds and the jocks.
Sure.
And they were all, you know, like some of you who may have gone through this, the people you were friends with in elementary school, everyone grows up and does something different in middle school. By high school, some of your best friend could be your enemy. And Courtney Gaines, it was like, remember when you broke your arm and we carried you 3 blocks? Yeah. You know, that's what his speech to the big jock.
Back in the day, if you could get into the popular group, you would absolutely just cut the legs out from under any of your long-term friends. Like, they could be old family friends.
But Camp I Me Love taught you that once you get into the popular group, you realize your nerdy friends are a lot more fun to hang out with.
Is that what it taught us?
Maybe not.
I think it taught us that you can buy love, honestly. Oh, well, I think at the end, because didn't he get the lady at the end and it all came from paying him money? I can't remember that movie.
She realized, she's like, you know, I would have liked you either way.
Yeah, I feel like the unfortunate 1980s-fication of that storyline is that money can buy you love.
Well, it's Martha Coolidge. I mean, she's a great director. Go look her up, you know.
Because this is really bugging me. Every single podcast, No Shade Danny podcast out there, has been covering The Burbs. When they talk about Gail Gordon, who plays Walter, they always talk about his connection to I Love Lucy.
Yep.
Right?
2 episodes, right?
He was in 2 different shows of I Love Lucy. I can't remember what they are.
Mr. Mooney in the second season. Yeah. The second part. The second
one. And the reason I don't care is because I knew him from when he was on the radio show, Our Miss Brooks.
And apparently not just you, Matt, because
when
Gail Gordon was auditioning for this movie, I guess poor Gail Gordon and a lot of stars from yesteryear at that time would get these young hotshot directors who had no idea who they were and were just like, do you look right for the part or do you not look right? And Joe Dante remembered him from old movies, from I Love Lucy, from the radio shows, and was just talking his ear off, giving him the respect he deserved. That Gail Gordon, when he left, he said, you know what? I don't even need to read the script. I'm in.
Nice. That's
great. The kind of guy, I mean, Joe Dante is one of those guys who just... if you look through all his films, he's found ways throughout the years to bring some of those old Hollywood guys back in.
Yeah.
Dick Miller.
We'll
get to Dick Miller. Don't worry. He's in every film. But Joe Dante, again, and I can't stress this enough, knows how to cast
him. We might have to have a whole episode just about Dick Miller. Like, after the stuff you were telling me about him.
This guy.
And, seeing Chopping Mall the other day, I was watching Chopping Mall. And Dick Miller's amazing performance in that as, like...
Right up there just, with Piranha.
Yeah, just his like, 3 minutes of basically yelling at a robot while cleaning up, like, pink slime.
You clumsy son of a bitch! Look what you did! I ought to turn you into scrap metal for this!
Hey, I see your identification badge, please.
Identification badge?
Do not make any sudden moves.
Sudden move? I'll give you a sudden move upside your head!
I mean, if you're an aspiring actor or anything, look up Dick Miller, because if there was ever a Renaissance man, a Renaissance person who's just do the work, you will get there.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy, he was in the Navy. He then went to City College of New York, Columbia, NYU, got a PhD in psychology. While working in Bellevue Hospital in the mental ward, he was also performing on Broadway.
Oh my God.
Guy eventually then leaves Broadway to go to LA to write scripts. Long story short, 180 films later, he's in every Joe Dante movie.
Yeah, this guy doesn't sleep.
He pops up. I mean, none of us have seen
him. I mean, literally everyone will only know him as, despite all that wonderful stuff you said, he's Mr. Futterman from Gremlins.
Or
that's what everyone,
or the garbage man in The Burbs.
That's what everyone will remember him as, Mr. Futterman from Gremlins and Gremlins 2. But what an amazing dude. An absolute amazing dude. I love every time I see him in a movie. It's fantastic. He never lets you down.
No matter how long or how short he's in a film, he is worth being there.
Oh, he gives it 140%. He outshines everybody.
Absolutely. Okay, we could do an entire episode on Dick Miller. Like I said. And we probably will. Let's move on.
To cover. Okay, so hopefully I didn't blow out everyone's ears yelling, move it on. Corey Feldman, we really need to discuss Corey Feldman in this movie, because this might be the last Corey Feldman movie that was really worth its salt.
When you're a kid, and when for us, Corey Feldman had been in so many great films up to this point, you know, Goonies,
Name them
Lost
all.
Boys,
in alphabetical
order. I mean, I can't do that. You're the obsessive compulsive person who has all your toys.
I know. Well, because he had been in Gremlins, right? And he was amazing in Gremlins. And then, yeah, he was in Goonies. I think at that point he'd been in License to Drive.
Probably, yeah, actually, yeah.
Wasn't that it?
And he'd just come back, but you wouldn't know this if you lived in that time period, if you were around in the 80s. Apparently he had filmed Dream a Little Dream right before this movie.
Yes, so
this movie comes out before Dream a Little Dream. Because for me, Dream a Little Dream is a movie not a lot of people like. It kind of feels like a made-for-TV movie.
Sure.
And maybe kind of ended a career or other stuff. But I love the film. But I always thought that was his last film. I didn't realize that he'd filmed that before.
Well, and that's – and to preface, he had made lots of movies after this movie. But this is the last Corey Feldman – like
vehicle.
I would say, yeah, this is the last thing where he's on brand. This is what everyone remembers.
And again, about Corey, guys, Feldman. I cannot stress enough how great Joe Dante is at respecting actors and respecting people that he brought that, you know, like, you know, he'd worked with Corey Feldman when he was a little kid and he brought him back for this film.
Yeah.
You know, he gave him sort of his last break. He did that. Apparently they did the same thing for Jerry Goldsmith. Like when Jerry Goldsmith was, his very last film is the Looney Tunes film.
Oh, really?
And Jerry Goldsmith is such a hard worker, puts so much work into his scores that he'd actually, the movie before, I forget what the film is, I wish I knew it, but the film he had made before Looney Tunes, they actually scrapped his score. So for a guy who has over 200 movies to his name, one of the greatest film conductors of all time, composers, to have your last film scrapped by the people and they brought someone else in to redo the film, Joe Dante still hired him knowing he was sick, knowing this might be his last film. And you know, that's the kind of person Joe Dante is.
Oh, and he killed it. He knocked it out of the park. Yeah. Absolutely. I could not see this movie having any other soundtrack to it. Like, especially after you watch the work print and you see that filler music they have in, the Jerry Goldsmith music is its own character living amongst these people.
Jerry Goldsmith, he brings the contrast. He has so much playful stuff in the score. Little dogs barking every once in a while.
Yeah.
You know, really takes you, gives you those comedic throwback moments if you look like old films, along with a really good horror film soundtrack. But let's go back to Corey Feldman. You were talking about Corey Feldman.
Wendy Schall was talking in that little documentary about when Corey Feldman was on set. He was not at his best. He had started to get into, you know, his drug habit. It's funny because a lot of it doesn't come across in the movie. The movie, he seems like he's all work. He's in his character the whole time.
Hey, Mrs. Rumsfeld. No tan lines this morning. Looks nice.
I would say that this is Corey Feldman's peak Feldman.
I think so.
Because after this, he did do the voice for Donatello in Ninja Turtles. But after that, I don't know, nothing really had any quality to it.
Well, Bruce Dern calls him a meatball.
That kid next door is a meatball.
I thought that was an interesting connection that he calls him a meatball. This is 1989. And then in 1994, Corey Feldman stars in Meatballs 4.
Because we all remember 2 and 3.
Yes. I remember watching Meatballs 4. I think that was a USA Up All Night special that I'd watched at some point. Ah, remember USA Up All Night?
Oh, yeah.
You watched that?
I did watch that.
Hi, it's Rhonda with two great movies and the best of 1993. Next on USA Up All Night.
Now, did you specifically watch Fridays for Rhonda Shear? Or did you also watch Saturdays?
I see. I don't think I watched... Like, Friday was still probably a pretty busy TV movie night with my parents. We had one TV, so you kind of watch what they watch.
So you're like Gilbert Gottfried Saturdays?
Yeah, so
you're
me,
just completely missed?
For me, it was Saturdays. I mean, and then maybe... I have to say, our mutual friend Wyatt...
Oh, my God.
Wyatt, hanging out with
you're
Wyatt...
You're killing me.
I think that's where I got into Friday night.
Just the absolute devastating sexual power of Rhonda Shear. Like in between, like everyone talks about Elvira. And yes, like Elvira was wonderful. She is wonderful. I'll never speak ill against her. But Rhonda Shear, in those little breaks between the movies, those cornball movies, I mean, absolutely wonderful. Like stuff of legend. I still think about it today.
Stay tuned for Young Nurses in Love coming up next. Until we meet again next Friday night, remember from the keeper of the sizzle kiss, if it's LA, it's Rhonda up all night.
night.
When I started watching this again, something I noticed right away was that this movie, even though it is filmed on the Universal lot, right, it doesn't feel like it's filmed on a lot, but it does feel like it is filmed in a place where these people are trapped, if yes. that makes sense.
Yeah, you definitely almost have like
Punxsutawney, like you cannot leave.
Which is probably what the Burbs feel like.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, you had brought up the fact that, so this takes place, as we all know, on that cul-de-sac, that famous cul-de-sac in Universal Studios. And it's where they filmed the Leave It to Beaver show, right?
Oh, yeah. The Munsters.
Yes, the Munsters. So Corey Feldman's house is the Munsters' old house, which is crazy. And then you'd said Leave It to Beaver's house was Ray's house?
Yeah, I think it's Ray's house. Yeah.
Are you absolutely sure? Don't bring that crap on this show and like, you know, not know.
I have some of the broad information.
We're going to be roasted now, bro.
You're very specific. You are very specific.
Oh, you're killing me here. Well, so let's travel over to Mayfield Place and let's take a look in those barred up basement windows.
All right, let's do it.
So what I love about this movie right when it starts is the fact that we've never seen a Universal logo do something before. Like Universal logos now do stuff all the time.
Yeah, all the logos play with that, you know. But
right?
Yeah.
It's absolutely commonplace. Warner Brothers, Universal, all these different places. Even New Line Cinemas, I think, does some cool stuff. But this has this direct like meteor drop right into the middle of America. And I am so crazy that I actually got out Google Earth and I was trying to look at where this is on the map. And it basically, I have a problem with the movie because the movie itself, the license plate on the back of Ray's Wagoneer.
Oh, you're going
to
get very specific.
Actually
there.
Matches up to an Illinois license plate. Even though it doesn't say Illinois on it, it says drive safe. Everything about it is an Illinois license plate from 1989. But when they drop into the map actually drops into Iowa.
Oh, does it?
Yes. Like there is an area in Iowa called Johnston, Iowa, that looks almost exactly like this. I watched it over and over and over again. There's no way they could be in Illinois because they're not close enough to the Great Lakes.
Okay. You would have saw some of that. But
yeah. And so when you look at it.
This is Midwest, Midwest.
Yeah. Because Illinois is so close to Iowa. I mean, their border touches. And it's like you are actually going over, you know, probably like 60, 70, 80 miles from where, you know, Illinois would be. Like, and the closest town that would even match this. That's why I say this is in another dimension.
Yeah.
Because nothing here matches. First of all, Iowa and Illinois don't have hills, not like this, and not like what's represented in the movie. If you look when they come in, the entire cul-de-sac is on the edge of this large Hollywood-style hill.
Yeah.
And Ray's house and the Klopek's house actually butt up against a cliff.
But
and yet in the movie, there's these big hills behind them because in real life, there were hills behind them.
Yeah. I just remember when this opened. You know, because you remember, you're picking up a VHS from a video store and you're judging a book by its cover.
Yes.
And the second the logo does this and you get transported onto this map, and none of us had ever seen Google Map. We didn't have the internet. None of us existed. So,
and yet they nailed it.
And none of us had seen a shot like this before. But you know, or you suspect, I chose correctly. This is going to be a good movie.
The movie starts off with Ray going across the street to look at some dirty old house. Like it's very, the Klopek's house itself is insane.
Yeah. I mean, I love the detail where he's got nice bushes on his side. And then on the other side, the bushes are just.
Yeah. And that goes to that great cartoony aspect of this movie where things do not happen how they happen in real life at all.
No.
Literally, I mean, he literally steps over into their property and the wind starts picking up like some bad omen.
And then
as
he backs his foot away, the wind just stops.
Yeah, I love it. It's just, it's very cornball horror aspect, very paranormal. which is
and
funny.
And yet done, like, subtly.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's done right overtly, but, I mean, Dante, again, is so good at giving you those subtle touches that are over the top, but he makes them feel like,
yeah,
just stick with it. Dante is like the Marx Brothers. Joe Dante is like the Marx Brothers, where at the same time, you had the Zucker Brothers doing Naked Gun movies.
Yeah.
And those guys were like the Three Stooges. Everything was really in your face, really big. Dante is like, you know, the Marx Brothers. It's like you have these surreal moments, but they're done subtly. Like, they put you into this world, and you just go with it.
Yeah. No, and that's also something that, you know, with the house being so gross, people who have seen this movie, which hopefully, again, is everyone.
We paused and waited for you to watch it, so.
It's on you. But it's funny because there's, you realize what had happened with the, you know, with the Klopex and the Knapps and everything. And you're like, what was this house like when the Knapps lived there? Yeah. Because you get a sense that the new neighbors are truly new neighbors. Like, if we're talking about them in the very next scene, basically, about, hey, anybody met the new neighbors? They couldn't have been there for longer than, like, what, a month?
And because it's a Joe Dante film, if the movie started a few weeks earlier, like, in a Joe Dante film, you could have a very pristine, nice home with a nice lawn, and you could have it overnight turn into this disaster house. Well, yeah,
that's the kind of the funny thing is, like, how bad was this house looking when the Knapps lived there? Because Ray says something about how, you know, they worked in their yard. They, you know, they had normal, they were normal people.
And this could add to the prejudice of the suburbs. Like, we might, like, part of this house could just represent how those nosy suburban neighbors, they view you.
Yeah.
So, like, this could be a really nice house to anyone else who just drove by and looked at it, but we're looking through the eyes of suburbanites.
Yeah.
And they're just like, you don't belong here.
It's like the only way that the house could get that gross that quickly is, like, again, a metaphysical, paranormal issue where the Klopex being in the house actually rotted the house. Like, the house actually became rotten because of their presence.
Or if it was a house in California and you didn't water for a week.
They've been here a month. You think they're going to do something about their yard?
So Ray is somehow on vacation from work, but we don't know if the vacation is taking place during a holiday, but no one in this movie works. Like, no. Like, even though they're told, we're told they have jobs, at least Rumsfeld is most likely an arms dealer.
Yeah, he seems retired military.
Yeah, for sure. Retired military.
Probably has a good pension or, you know, benefits, good benefits.
But he might own, like, a gun shop because he has all this cool equipment and everything, and he seems really excited about showing it off in certain scenes.
Walter's retired and obviously does well because his neighbor, his lawn's
immaculate. Oh, yeah, because he buys Chem Lawn.
He brings in the nice, the nice fertilizing company.
But then we have no idea what Art does, ever. We never find out what Art does for an actual job, but his wife is on vacation.
He never mentions he's on vacation. But
no, he doesn't. That's a funny thing because he asks Ray. So the next day, Art comes out. You know, he shoots the gun and invites himself in for like 7 pounds of breakfast.
Oh, when you see him eat breakfast, you realize – later on, you're like, oh, his wife's on vacation. This guy's just coming over and raiding the fridge.
Right.
And Carrie Fisher is not happy.
No, absolutely. Like, I actually not put that together. That's funny. He's like, his wife's gone. So, of course, he's coming over to try to scam breakfast. What are you guys eating in there?
He's eating breakfast. He's rummaging through the fridge for leftovers.
Yeah, ribs, pineapple.
Takes a little handful of the dog food as she's walking by.
God, that took me.
Eats it. We don't even know that he's eating dog food until she puts it down for the dog to eat. And Art makes a little face, but then just keeps eating the other
takes
food.
Takes a big drink of coffee.
Hey, Ray, you going to finish those eggs?
I know. I love that scene. That took me a couple of years. I didn't catch that when I was a kid. And then I rewatched it, you know, multiple years later, I finally caught that he took a big bite of dog food. Again, though, that morning before Art comes over, just to jump back, there's a whole scene where he and Carol are, like, Ray and Carol are having a fight about, like, Carol's pissed off that, you know, he's going to be obsessing about the neighbors and, you know, he's going to ruin his vacation.
He's on vacation. He needs to relax.
What?
Nothing.
What, Carol? What did you know was going to happen?
It started already.
Look at you. You're going to sit around the house all week doing nothing, get bored out of your mind, and go back to work in worse shape than you are now.
No, I'm not.
Oh, please, let's pack up the car and go to the lake. Just get away from here and rest. You should see yourself. You were up at the crack of dawn watching a dog poop.
The entire time, their son is eating cereal and watching some cartoon on TV and does not look or talk to either of them, and they do not acknowledge him.
And this captures the 80s perfectly.
Yeah.
Whenever my parents had whenever they would get into little arguments, we would just turn the TV off.
Yeah, it's really weird because it's like, it feels in this modern age very strange to watch that scene. They're like, they aren't taking into account their son. And it's like, nope, that's how it was. Yeah. Like, your parents conducted business all around you.
We were background.
Did not care what you were doing.
And 10 o'clock at night, do you know where your kids are?
Yeah, it's very interesting because it's in this modern perspective, it seems weird and almost cruel. And I do think it was put in the script where Tom Hanks wasn't so fatherly.
Yeah.
Truly. But it's also plays very well with what I was like when I was 9.
Yeah. I mean, all the dads were kind of Tom Hanks back then.
Yeah.
Today, right? Today we're engaged with our kids. We're taking them places. We're doing everything. No, that was not 1989.
No, he just goes, hey, don't hang out with Ricky Butler. And that's pretty much it.
Ricky Butler, who's another, like, I mean, probably a latchkey kid because we never see his parents.
No, they're out till Thursday. They don't come back till Thursday.
Okay.
So something in that scene where Art is having breakfast, like, and they start talking about the Klopex and how they, you know, has anybody met the neighbors? He has this line that is really weird because he says he talked to the real estate woman who in the script says showed them the house, but in the movie it is sold them the house.
I did talk to the real estate broad that sold the place. Apparently their last house, it only burnt to the ground.
But then immediately, having seen the movie, you're like, how was the house on the market? Because they killed the Knapps and took the house.
Because originally, we do know that there were so many endings to this film because they kept trying to figure out what the ending was going to be.
Yeah.
So even they, along the way, are change it at the end. Yeah. But it works so well.
I know. And that's what was so weird about that is because there are, if people who don't know, there was never a plan for what the Knapps were doing. It was all supposed to be random noises and sounds and weird nefarious things. And originally, they were not supposed to necessarily be bad guys. It was supposed to be the people of the burbs being paranoid and putting all of this paranoia on the Klopex. And it turns out that they didn't really do anything wrong.
Yeah, like you have the big Tom Hanks speak at your end. It's not them, it's us.
Yes.
What you were saying about people in the burbs are people like Skip. People who mow their lawn for the 800th time and then snap! Well, that's us! It's not them! That's us! We're the ones who are vaulting over the fences and peeking in through people's windows! We're the ones who are throwing garbage in the street and lighting fires! We're the ones who are acting suspicious and paranoid! We're the lunatics! Us! It's not them! It's us.
You know, and that was one of the ideas, was that the crazy ones are actually all your neighbors in the burbs. You were just trying to live a friendly, happy little life. You were sold what the burbs were going to be. Here's what the burbs really are.
Yeah. And you can kind of see that from the opening. The opening, there are no heroes in this movie, truly. I mean, the paper boy throws a paper directly at Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks throws scalding hot morning coffee at the paper boy. Immediately, Gail Gordon's character, Walter, yells the paper boy, oh, watch it, you little.
Well, and that's what I love about this film. Again, I cannot stress, this film is all about contrast. Because, again, you don't know what you're getting into. We picked it up at a video store. We're watching it. You get that first great shot. Then all of a sudden, it's nighttime, spooky house, the wind blows. And you cut right away to like a Leave It to Beaver, perfect idyllic America.
And yet every person at every house is a jerk.
Yeah.
Straight up is a jerk. Even when Rumsfeld comes out. He's all big and stern. You're like, okay, well, this guy's just like really patriotic.
Comes out to like rock music.
He's got an American Eagle porch light, I noticed.
Yeah.
And I think his mailbox is actually on two giant like warship shells.
Okay.
It's very weird. Like, I think they're on these giant shells that, like, warships would shoot.
And as a kid, I mean, it's 1989, all the sitcoms were, like, trying to show you the idyllic, like, you know, like, how happy families are, how everything's going. You get this film. When you're a kid and you see all these neighbors being a little off, a little, like, snooty, a little rude, you're just, like, you love it. You just cannot wait to see what this film's going to be.
I know. But even him, like, you know, he steps in Queenie's dog poop, and he immediately is going to go beat the shit out of an old man.
And you know it's happened before because his wife Wendy is like, whoa,
yeah, play, hey. Exactly. And so it's like, so far you're not showing me. And then Art is running around with a gun, just straight up shooting at houses. Like, no one in this movie is mentally grounded.
I mean, you have
Ricky. Except for maybe Carol.
You have Ricky Butler trying to paint the house, and he's spilling paint left and right.
Well, and then later in the movie, if you notice, he's painted two of the banisters red and blue. And also, the amount of paint cans on his porch and his lawn grows and grows and grows like critters. Like, I was at one point, in the background, when Ray and Art are going to walk up and say hello to the Klopex, right? I looked in the background and there's over, like, I think like 10 paint cans just in Ricky Butler's yard. And then later in the movie, when they're sort of like digging in the basement and they've got the whole party scene going, he has even more paint cans. There's even more paint cans in his garage and everything. So I don't know what's going on, but this kid does about 10 minutes of painting and has about 70 gallons of paint to do it with.
That's so funny. Yeah, there's just so many great little moments in this film.
Yeah, it's wild. But one thing, again, that Art was talking about I lost my train of thought on that.
Okay. Sorry, one thing I would say, yeah, there's so many great moments in this film that, like, do you notice that when Rumsfeld is putting the flag up, in the background, his car is completely covered in camouflage?
Oh, yeah.
It looks like a bush.
Yes, it's wild. You don't even notice his car. You truly don't notice his car there if you're not looking for it. It's wild.
It could just be the neighbor's bush for all that. But you see the details of the wheels. Again, like a cartoon, you see the contours of the car. You see the wheels, but it feels like a car made out of a bush.
Yes. There's so many attentions to detail in this movie. And at the same time, like, things where you're like, Is anyone actually paying attention to how crazy this world is? Because there's just so many weird things that pop out for me. Like, what is it? Oh, there's Art has like 15 different costume changes in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, he's always...
Like, you have no idea when this movie takes place. Like, you know it's probably roughly the same year that it came out, right? So we can establish that. We have no idea what time of the year is going on.
Yeah.
We assume that it's somewhere near the summer. But like Illinois and Iowa, in, you know, like around either Labor Day or Memorial Day, which is likely why a lot of people have it off. Right. It's only like 70 degrees.
Like, and these guys are like,
yeah. And these guys are like wearing shorts.
Middle
and,
summer.
Yeah. He doesn't even have a shirt on. Like, you know, Mark Rumsfeld comes out in just a vest and little shorts and boots, and it's the morning time. Is the morning the hottest time of the day? I don't think so.
Well, and again, I love all the attention to detail because, like, the movie is so cartoony, but it doesn't, you're not, it's not trying to oversell it. Like, when Art gets electrocuted and he falls through the shed.
Yeah.
The next scene, you're looking down at the shed and you have a cartoon outline of Art.
Yes.
Like, it's just the outline.
And then
of him.
People wonder how Gremlins 2 got the Batman symbol when the Gremlins bat went through the wall. And they're like, oh, that's so cheesy. It's like, this movie's like a precursor to like all the things that happen.
Yeah. I mean, Dante's so ahead. 2. I mean, he's so ahead of what meta becomes.
Yeah.
What movies become in the 90s and the 2000s. He's doing, but he does it with a subtle touch.
Yeah. No, and see, and I'm glad you brought up Art going up to that pole and cutting the pole. I was looking at this last night, and it's funny because I also have to credit the Burbs Minute because they do have the ability to really go deep into Art's background. In a way that we just don't have time for here. But one thing that's funny is that when I was little, I thought Art worked for the power company.
So did I. Right? Yeah, actually.
I thought he worked for the power company because of that moment when he's got the helmet on. It says Art.
He's got
it says
all the gear.
Municipal power on his shirt. He's got the belt. He has the proper equipment. He's got the gloves. But what you've come to find out watching this movie is that Art might be like
Bugs Bunny or something.
Yeah, he might be like this self-made millionaire who just has tons of costumes in his walk-in closet somewhere.
And what Joe Dante loves to do, I mean, this could be a Looney Tunes movie. In Joe Dante's world, like if you were watching a Looney Tunes cartoon, as soon as somebody went up a power, they'd have the power outfit. Yeah. The second they did something, they'd be in an army outfit.
Well, that's what it feels like.
If you were going to go golfing, you'd have that Bob Hope outfit from the 30s.
No, and what's funny is he puts on that elaborate golfing outfit, right? And he's like, hey, Carol, we're going to go golfing. You know, that's why we're going to do so much golfing.
Think she bought this.
Yeah, and then smash cut to him now in a full power company outfit.
Yeah.
Like 15 minutes later, tops. He has taken all that stuff off and he has redressed himself in a full hard hat, shirt, gloves, uniform.
And why not, Matt? He lives next door.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like, but then you're like, okay, well, he had all this equipment, obviously, because he works for the power company. He's got this set of plans in his hands. I don't know where he got power company plans.
And I love why he has those. I love when he cuts the wire. For a split second, he's not quite sure which one he's going to cut. Yeah. And then he cuts it. And like everyone's surprised, like Bruce Dern's like, oh, the alarm's off. You did it. You knew what you were doing. We find out later in the movie, he cut off the power to the entire neighborhood.
Yeah, he didn't know what the hell he was doing at all.
Yeah.
So, but that's the crazy thing is you find out right away, he starts climbing up the pole and, you know, Ray looks over at Mark and says, why didn't you go up there? And he's like, well, it's very high. He didn't say because Art works for the power company. Yeah. He is an expert at this. I mean, and then Art goes to look at the plans to know which one to cut, and they just fall out of his hands.
Yeah, only like, to cut the wrong wire, cut a wire, get electrocuted, fall into a shed, and then come out just like a cartoon, smoke rising off of him, and his fingernails are all black, and he puts his finger into his fillings.
The fillings are hot.
Oh, my feelings are hot.
Hey, look at this. The man actually hit the right wire. There's no alarm.
And it's so funny. Like, they went so deep into that bit that everything in his wallet's melted.
Yeah.
Like,
when they go to get the credit card,
wallet was affected. Yeah. They went so cartoony with that. But, like, again, that's why Art steals this movie away.
Yeah.
Because what is Art? Who is Art? What is happening? Like, he has that great story about Skip, right? Like, I love it. Like, he has, like, the best lines in this movie because he's, like, tells that wonderful story about Skip. We haven't even talked about that awesome nightmare scene or anything. Like, there's so many things in this movie we're not going to be able to get to because we're going to be over time. But it's, like, there's, you know, that whole nightmare where, you know, he comes out dressed as Skip, which is so wild.
Like he's got the ice cream suit, the glasses.
Again, a costume change.
Another costume change. He's holding part of an ice cream, like a cream float maker that's all covered in blood.
Yeah, and he's doing like Bob Hope stand up, like, who the heck ordered the blood shake?
Hey, Ray. It's not Skip. It's me, Art. I'm just pretending to be Skip. Hey, you didn't have the sea and ice pick around here, did you?
And I love, like, as he's running with the shake thing, you still see the plug just dangling.
Yeah.
As if we're in the real world and you're carrying something not plugged in. And I can't stress this enough, and you see it in all Joe Dante's films, but if you were watching a Zucker Brother film, you know, and all this stuff was happening, like, you are aware that this shouldn't be happening. But in a Joe Dante film, it's like you're watching a cartoon. And when you're watching a cartoon, we don't think about all this stuff that you can't do. We just go with it. And the Burbs, you just go with it.
Yeah.
It's just subtle. All these crazy things are happening, but you're glued and it feels normal. It feels like, why wouldn't this stuff happen?
Yeah. No, and this is one of the only final things that I'll say about the movie is that this movie has a real interesting theme with fire that I never noticed before. Like, after Art says that the Klopex house burned down, right? You see containers of gasoline all over this movie. Not just, like, there's one in Ray's garage. There's one in the basement of the Klopex house. There's kerosene in the Klopex house. In the scene when they go over and they visit the Klopex, right? That monstrous scene with Bruce Dern just going, "What do you got in the cellar here, Klopex?" Right? When Brother Theodore opens that door to Brother Theodore, there's a noose shadow in the background, like on the wall. There's actually the shadow of a noose hanging down. I don't know why. I don't know what it's doing there, but it's hilarious. And then I noticed that there were fire extinguishers all over that house. And it's a really weird thing. Like, you kind of don't notice it at first. And then you're like, what's going on? Holy shit. There's like fire extinguishers everywhere. There's a fire extinguisher in a box sitting next to, I think, either Ray or Carol. There's a fire extinguisher next to the table when they sit down and there's all the candles.
Because I was going to say, again, with the subtlety, when they sit down, when that scene happens with all the candles, it starts off with just two or three candles and the doctor is saying, oh, I have some candles to make it romantic for the girls. And as soon as he gets out of the way of the camera, we see that table.
Yes. It's like 20 candles in the middle. On fire.
Just ridiculous.
Yes. And then next to, like on the right, there is a fire extinguisher. There is another fire extinguisher in a different shot up on a mantle.
That's crazy.
And then you do reverse shot, a different mantle has another small fire extinguisher. There's a fire extinguisher by the front door, and there's a fire extinguisher on the stairs. Like, it's all in one house. And so it's kind of funny because it really plays to that bit about how their last house burnt down.
And they're just all panicked.
Now they have fire extinguishers everywhere. I thought that was so fascinating. I was like,
furnace in the basement that's shooting fire out.
Exactly.
You'd be very nervous.
When you build a crematorium, you really need to have that backup.
But with all this fire, like extinguishers and everything, Bruce Dern always gets the funny line. It's like when his first, talking to Hans.
Yep.
And Hans picks up the picture with the pretty girl in the frame.
Yeah.
And Bruce Dern's like, one of yours? And Hans is like, no, it came with the frame.
Oh, it came with the frame? Oh, man. Yeah, that is probably one of the scenes that's a little bit hard to watch as, in the 2023 era, 2024 era, because he is sort of like playing into the few of those stereotypes, which is a little tough.
Yeah.
But other than that, I think the movie kind of holds up socially.
Yeah.
But that did get harder to watch when you're a little bit older. But yeah, so many wild things in that movie just do not add up. There's also a funny scene where they're running back from being covered in bees, Ray and Art.
Oh yeah.
And you don't notice unless you're looking in the background, Gail Gordon starts running into his house and then they cut away, they cut back and he runs into his house again. Like,
oh, man.
It's like they're doing a second take.
Yeah.
And so he starts from the same starting point twice.
That's hilarious.
And it's just something that I was really paying attention to. And, I was looking in my notes here. We didn't mention poor Robert Picardo. Garbage man number two.
That's true. I mean, and he is actually of our time today.
Yeah.
He's very much like, look.
Supreme Court rule that a person's garbage is public domain the minute it hits the curb.
Shut up.
You guys pick up a hefty bag out of that yard that was bulky and probably a little bit moist.
What the hell is wrong with these people?
He has a right to know, Vic. Don't start up with me.
As good old Dick Miller is just like, can you help out a little bit? And what does he do? The other guy just pours the trash on the ground and helps out.
I love that. And it's so funny how forward thinking that character accidentally ended up being.
Yeah.
I love that character.
Dick Miller, because he's like, who's going to clean this up? You're just pouring trash everywhere.
You're
going
to clean it up because you are a garbage man. I pick up garbage in cans now from the street.
I hate the cul-de-sacs. There's only one way out.
I know. And what I love about that too is like, everything becomes a character in this movie. The Klopex house is a character, right? The soundtrack is a character. All
that
the characters
pile of trash.
Are characters. Yeah, the dogs are characters. That pile of trash does become its own character. It never leaves until the reshoots at the very end.
And you forget about it until when Walter shows back up at the end.
Yeah,
and he drives through it. That's a trash.
I also noticed something that I think was funny, and I don't know how much of a pre-thought that it was, but under the context that the Knapps are killed by the Klopeks, and the Klopeks have just taken over their home,
yeah,
right? And not really changed anything. And there's the scene where they drive the garbage down, beat the hell out of it with a stick. I've never seen that.
Yeah.
When they start pulling stuff out the next morning and Art is dumping everything on the ground, you notice in that trash, there's like coffee cans and bingo cards.
Oh, I did not notice that.
Yeah. I mean, it's like the normal trash is normal, but the bingo cards are weird to me because that to me is signaling that they're throwing out the Knapps stuff.
Yeah.
Right? That old people used to live here. A few bags
a day every time the trash
came. Exactly. Comes. Yeah. They're slowly throwing out the Knapps stuff every single day.
I never saw a moving truck.
Oh, it was there all day.
Funny fact for the ending. I mean, now that we're wrapping it up, it's all about the ending, is there's so many little behind the scenes and extra stuff from this movie and the DVD. But one thing that's not there are all the different alternate endings. And apparently Joe Dante had all these endings on a VHS tape, and he was going to include them, you know, for some supplemental footage, or at some point he was going to include them.
Yeah, the alternate endings, one was that the Knapps had drove away with Ray, and Ray presumably gets killed. That was an ending.
Another ending was when you open up the back of the trunk, instead of all the skeletons, it was going to be
cheerleaders. One of them was dead cheerleaders. It was
going to be the garbage men.
Yes, the two garbage men were going to be dead in there.
So he had all these different endings. So he goes to make a copy of the VHS tape, and he takes it to a mom and pop shop, just some small little shop in LA, to make a copy for him. And he, instead of giving them a new VHS tape, he gives them some other VHS tape to record over, which is very 80s.
Yeah.
And apparently what the shop did, they recorded the other VHS over the footage of all the alternate endings, destroying it forever.
Oh, no.
But that nothing is more 80s than just bringing an old tape you want to record over.
Yeah.
Instead of just forking up the $3.99 for a new tape.
Right. And he didn't have like a dual VHS to do this himself? No?
Nope,
nothing?
Nope.
I feel like my grandma was stealing videos back then with a dual VHS. Like, I've never seen a woman who's nicer commit more larceny than her. Like,
every murder she would
rent videos, and then she would dub them and then give them back. And she had tons and tons of movies. It's like
VHS tapes full of FBI warnings.
Yeah. That's for another show.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Well, that was The Burbs. That was great. I loved it. That was so much fun. We really appreciate you guys coming down to the shelter today. Hopefully you'll come back to see us real soon. But for now, we gotta go, as do you. Back out into that oblivion, folks. I'll see you later.
See you.